Everyone was looking for David. It was restless nights for weeks.
One of several accused stands trial for the murder of a Palmer teenager. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, May 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, lawmakers end the session.
It's my honor and privilege, Mr. Speaker. Under Uniform Rule 52, I move that the 30th Alaska State Legislature adjourn sine die.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds, narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart. Protect it. This message sponsored by Alaska Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
The first of several defendants charged in the high-profile 2016 murder of a Palmer teenager went on trial today before a packed courtroom. Prosecutors say Eric Allmendinger was part of a small group of teenage accomplices in the beating, kidnapping, and execution of David Grunwald. Allmendinger's attorney says it's true his client failed to stop the others, but that he isn't guilty of murder. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove was in court today and has more.
Jurors heard testimony that David Grunwald was a clean-cut kid who never stayed out past his curfew. But one night in mid-November, the 16-year-old didn't come home at all. That prompted a massive volunteer search, and his Ford Bronco was found torched outside of town the next day. Grunwald's girlfriend, Victoria Mokelke, testified about the difficult days that followed.
Everyone was looking for David. It was restless nights for weeks. I didn't get to sleep for days and days looking for him. And it was just, we were hoping for anything.
About 2 weeks later, one of Allmendinger's alleged accomplices led investigators to Grunwald's body at another location, frozen to the ground and covered in a thin layer of snow. In his opening statement, Palmer District Attorney Roman Kalachek offered no clear explanation as to why the group allegedly lured Grunwald to a trailer at Allmendinger's house and then decided to attack him. That included beating Grunwald with Allmendinger's heavy pistol. But Kalachek says the defendant and the others all agreed on what to do next.
And that unanimous decision by them was that because the beating was so bad, because the gang beating was so bad, they could not leave a witness. So they made a unanimous decision to kidnap David, take him to a remote location, and execute him.
The prosecutor showed photos of Allmendinger and his friends dressed in gang colors, throwing up gang signs, and read aloud their text messages using slang terms for guns. In court Monday, Allmendinger looked different from the pictures, wearing a white shirt with his red hair slicked back. He appeared to wipe his eyes when Kalachek described Grunwald pleading for his life. Grunwald had apparently made a one-time mistake to hang out with the wrong crowd. And Allmendinger's attorney, John Iannacone, says as much, describing the murder victim as all-American. But the lawyer insists his client was only playing at being a gangster. Iannacone says the promise of smoking Allmendinger's marijuana attracted others to the trailer, and that Grunwald's death was the result of their bad intentions.
Eric Allmendinger's not guilty as the principal. What do I mean by that? He's not the one who pulled the trigger. Eric Allmendinger's not guilty as an accomplice. Why? Because he did not have the criminal purpose for David to die. He did not have the criminal purpose to kill David Grunwald.
Iannacone admits his client is guilty of lying afterward to help cover up the murder. But he pointed to another man charged as the shooter, Austin Barrett. The 20-year-old Barrett is implicated in the slaying, along with Dominic Johnson and Bradley Renfro. They are being tried separately. Allmendinger's trial continues this week, with court dates scheduled through next week. In Palmer, I'm Casey Grove.
The legislative session ended over the weekend. Fairbanks Democratic Representative David Guttenberg, who announced he is not running for re-election, closed the session at 1:48 a.m. on Sunday.
It's my honor and privilege, Mr. Speaker. Under Uniform Rule 52, I move that the 30th Alaska State Legislature adjourn sine die.
We're adjourned sine die.
The legislature passed a $5.4 billion budget. Here to talk about the wrap-up of the session is Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Lori.
Andrew, the legislature voted to draw money from Alaska Permanent Fund earnings to pay for state government for the first time. How will that work?
This year, half of the budget would be funded by a $2.7 billion draw from fund earnings. A billion of that would go to permanent fund dividends, which would be $1,600 this year. The draw follows a plan the legislature passed last week. Under the plan, the draw would be 5.25% of the fund's value for the next 3 years, and then would go down to 5%. Bethel Senator Lyman Hoffman marked the historic occasion. Here's Hoffman.
I believe that it's historic that we are using what many refer to as the rainy day account for the first time.
The plan doesn't say how much of the draw would go to PFDs, so that will be determined in the future.
Andrew, how well protected will the main part of the permanent fund be?
Of the $65 billion fund, $40 billion can't be touched under the state constitution. Another $16 billion are earnings that can be spent, and $9 billion are earnings that haven't been realized yet. They basically can't be spent, but they're not considered part of the earnings reserve fund. For the fund to be protected in the future, legislators are going to have to follow the plan they passed last week. But there's a problem. This year's budget has a roughly $700 million hole even after the earnings draw. So the legislature is using a separate piggy bank, the Constitutional Budget Reserve, to cover that gap. But that fund is running low. Governor Bill Walker was pleased that the plan passed, but he noted that there's still work to do.
It gives predictability. It protects the dividend going forward. It protects the permanent fund. And it closed 80% of the fiscal gap. We went from a $3.7 billion hole to a $700 million hole. Boy, that's a significant step. Is it done? No, it's not.
So unless oil prices stay high, the legislature is going to have to cut spending or PFDs or increase taxes or draw more on permanent fund earnings.
So beyond the budget, lawmakers passed a lot of other pieces of legislation. They include a statewide ban on smoking. What facilities does that ban cover?
Basically any workplace, and that includes bars and restaurants. There's already similar workplace smoking bans in both the largest city, Anchorage, and the capital city, Juneau. But the ban now would be in effect everywhere in Alaska.
Andrew, what about school funding? What happened there?
Well, if you remember, the legislature had already passed a school funding budget, but they added some additional money in the capital budget for schools. So there's $20 million that will essentially be spread out across the state to pay for a grant for each school district worth about $80 a student. On top of that, the state provided some funding for pre-kindergarten. In addition to all of that, there could be an unusual new source for school funding. The legislature passed a bill that would start a new raffle. Alaskans could contribute part of their PFDs, and 3/4 of that money would go to fund schools. The remaining 1/4 would go to pay for new raffle prizes, which would be the closest that Alaska has to a statewide lottery. I'll be working on stories in the coming days on that bill and others that passed in the sessions last week.
All right, Andrew, thank you for that update on the work of the second session of the 30th legislature.
You're welcome, Laurie.
That was state government reporter Andrew Kitchenman speaking to us from Juneau. Alaska State Senator Anna McKinnon says she will not seek re-election. Anchorage TV station KTVA reports the Eagle River Republican wants to spend more time with her family. McKinnon is a longtime state legislator. She was elected to 3 terms in the House starting in 2006 and first elected to the Senate in 2012. She's currently co-chair of the Senate Finance Committee and a member of the Republican-led Senate's leadership team. McKinnon is one of a number of Senate and House members who either plan to retire from the legislature or plan to run for another office. The military says it intercepted two Russian long-range bombers in the airspace near Alaska on Friday. The Air Force Times reports that officials with the North American Aerospace Defense Command, or NORAD, said the incident took place over international waters north of the Aleutian Chain. F-22 Raptor fighter jets were dispatched from Alaska to intercept the Russian Tu-95 Bear bombers, which never entered actual U.S. airspace and were escorted away without any problems. Such incidents are not uncommon in the airspace around Alaska. There were multiple interceptions last summer after a lull in 2016. Elsewhere around the globe this year, U.S. planes were escorted away by Russian aircraft in the Black Sea region. While there is nothing illegal about the flights, the tactic is seen as a mild provocation and a way of testing an adversary's air defense response capabilities. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a former Air Force pilot reflects on the Japanese invasion of Attu.
The time we came up here, the impression we were given, and this is voiced oral stuff, that we had nothing to stop the Japanese.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com. And by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
Firefighters mopped up the remains of a 250-acre wildfire on Sunday that busted out 2 days earlier in a residential area near Delta Junction. Alaska Division of Forestry spokesman Tim Mowry says the North Eielson fire spread quickly on Friday from a forested area off the Tanana Loop Extension Road northeast of Delta across three grassy farm fields before running into a forested area near several homes. Investigators are looking into the cause of the fire, which was initially thought to be from a tree falling on a power line. But fire managers said Saturday there are no power lines in the area where the fire began. South winds on Friday were blowing 20 to 30 miles an hour and gusting to 50. Mowry says it was the first significant wildfire of the season.
We've had a lot of, debris burns that have escaped, but nothing to this extent where we've got an air tanker.
Firefighters with State Forestry, BLM, Alaska Fire Service, and others kept the blaze from damaging any homes. Mowry said a forestry air tanker from Palmer dropped at least two loads of retardant to help keep it from spreading.
There were some structures immediately threatened, but that's been mitigated.
Residents of the area were on alert in case evacuations were ordered, but that didn't become necessary. According to a forestry report, three 20-person initial attack crews and a load of eight smoke jumpers worked into the early morning Saturday to contain the fire. A bulldozer was used Saturday to break up windrows and berms that caught fire, while about 80 personnel searched for hot spots and mopped up the perimeter, which was fully contained by Saturday night. Forestry's Delta Area Fire Management Officer Mike Goyette says most of the estimated 250 acres burned by the fire was farm fields. He says conditions throughout the area are expected to remain extremely dry until green up. Alaska State Troopers say a man died when he was crushed at the Matanuska-Susitna-Burra landfill facility in Palmer. Troopers, shortly before 9 a.m. today, took a call requesting an ambulance to the central landfill. Investigators say a contractor baling scrap metal was crushed by machinery. He could not be resuscitated. The state medical examiner will conduct an autopsy. The man's name has not yet been released because next of kin have not been notified. Alaska State Troopers say a pilot is dead after crashing early Saturday morning near Whittier. According to a trooper dispatch, the Alaska Rescue Coordination Center notified troopers that an emergency location transmitter had gone off in the area on Saturday morning. Troopers were not able to access the crash site due to weather, but both Rescue Coordination Center and U.S. Coast Guard helicopter crews were able to confirm the sole occupant of the small aircraft was dead. A Department of Public Safety helicopter team and the Alaska Mountain Rescue Group were able to reach the site today and recover the pilot's remains. Troopers say the body has been handed over to the state medical examiner office and next of kin has been notified. As of Monday morning, the pilot had not been publicly identified. Mark DeSimone has been convicted of first-degree murder in the death of Dulio Tony Rosales. A Juneau jury returned with a verdict on Friday morning after roughly 6 hours of deliberations that started Thursday. Trial originally started on April 25th. Maria Gonzalez says it was painful reliving the details of her husband's death over the last 3 weeks. Gonzalez is the widow of Rosales, who was shot and killed at an excursion inlet cabin in May of 2016. Gonzalez broke down and ran from the courtroom shortly after the verdict was read.
I think it will still open in my heart forever. Mm-hmm. Forever, because he took my husband. He was a really good man. You know, he didn't deserve to die like that. Nobody, not even him. Not even him.
Gonzalez and Rosales had a little girl who's now kindergarten age. For Gonzalez, feelings are still raw after 2 years.
Still emotional. You know? I've been waiting for this for 2 years. And finally I can say that he's going to be fine with God. And anyways, they're going to give him 100 years, but he's not going to bring my husband back. But at least they make justice for him. That makes me feel a little bit better.
The defense attorney didn't dispute that DeSimone shot Rosales. Instead, Assistant Public Defender Deborah McCauley argued the two shots were unintentional discharges from a revolver that did not have a required safety modification. Prosecution said there was nothing wrong with the operation of the revolver. Assistant District Attorney Amy Page argued that a repeated cocking, aiming, and firing of a single-action revolver was DeSimone's own choice. Sentencing is scheduled for September 12th. DeSimone faces a term of between 20 and 99 years in prison.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Sea Alaska will soon help its shareholders with burial and cremation costs. The Southeast Regional Native Corporation's board voted last week to offer bereavement benefits of up to $1,000. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Losing a loved one is difficult enough on its own. Add the cost of a funeral, burial, or cremation, and it can be too much to handle. $1,000 isn't enough to cover all expenses, which can easily top $10,000, but it can help. Sea Alaska Board of Directors Chairman Joe Nelson says the corporation's increased earnings allow it to offer the benefit.
This is one that's been out there for a long time, and we haven't been able to get there, but this year, because of our financial performance and our anticipated continued, solid performance, I think everyone in the company is just excited that we're able to move on this one this year.
Survivors will receive $1,000 when an original shareholder dies. That covers those enrolled in the corporation when it formed in the early 1970s. Original shareholders' descendants, plus those who inherited or were given stock, will receive up to that amount. The corporation says payments will be based on the number of voting shares at the time of the shareholder's death. Nelson says the board took action now because it has a new source of revenue.
It's a function of being in a healthy financial position and then having the specific carbon project where we want to associate that carbon program to a benefit that all shareholders will feel for generations to come.
That project allows Sea Alaska to sell carbon offset credits through a program based in California. It's complicated, but basically, the corporation keeps some of its forests intact in exchange for payments from polluters. Shareholder bereavement benefits began May 7th, the day Sea Alaska's board of directors approved the new program.
I think this is fantastic news for shareholders.
Nicole Hollingstad is a former Sea Alaska corporate secretary who's running for the board as an independent candidate. She's among other candidates and corporate critics who've called for bereavement benefits.
The most important thing about this announcement is that it just proves that when shareholders are united and are persistent in their voice in raising an issue, that we can actually accomplish the change that we're asking for.
Board Chairman Nelson says a recent survey showed the benefit among shareholders' top priorities. It was outranked by scholarships and dividends. Nelson says the mechanics of payments are being worked out. Applications will be available sometime in June. Sea Alaska estimates about 300 shareholders die every year. The corporation has between 22,000 and 23,000 shareholders. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
This week, we're sharing stories from the Battle of Attu and the Greater Aleutian Campaign of World War II. The conflict ended in the 1940s, but its legacy is still very much alive, both for the veterans who served and the Unungan people who were forced to leave during the fighting. Even now, many vets have never spoken to an evacuee and vice versa. So to commemorate what happened 75 years ago, KUCB invited people on both sides to sit down and reflect together. Today, we hear from Tara Bordakovsky, whose grandmother survived the internment at Funtner Bay, and retired Lieutenant Colonel Bob Brocklehurst, who served as a fighter pilot in the U.S. Air Force. A note to listeners, one of the people in this story uses a word that is offensive to Japanese people.
We were 21 years old then, most of us. The oldest could have been 27, and we were ready to go. We wanted to fly, and we wanted to just come on down the Aleutian. I don't think anybody in my squadron thought anything about being afraid. You were there to do your job. It was war. That's all we thought about.
My experience of the whole evacuation and the internment time comes from that perspective of my grandmother, who was interned in Funner Bay, you know, the Aleuts of St. Paul, and specifically her. I was probably about 21 years old when I found out about it. And she would talk, but I could tell that it was difficult. And she would only talk for so long, and then she would just have to stop. And, you know, so I didn't really push her, but she did want to tell her story. She did want other elders to get up and talk about it. And she did realize how important it was for us to know our own history, to hear what happened to the Aleuts, the Unungans here in Alaska. There are other communities, the Unungan communities, that were equally impacted and affected by this. And I know very, very little about their experiences. I wonder a lot about Attu and those Aleuts that were taken as prisoners of war over to Japan, and, you know, where...
See, I didn't know that at the time. We didn't know that.
Uh-huh.
When I got there, our army was still fighting three battle areas.
So, Bob, when you were in Attu during that time...
I was the first fighter pilot to land on Attu and on Shemya, yes, ma'am.
And when you were there at that point, were the Aleuts already taken as prisoners of war at that point?
I never heard anything about the natives. I often wondered, what happens to the natives up here? I flew into Atka, I flew into Adak, and you never heard anything or seen anything about the natives. It was always in my mind, what happened to it? I didn't know about the evacuation of the natives and that they were sent to other places in Alaska. And, of course, up here I learned the story of the elders as you describe it, a very touching story.
What I always have mixed emotions and thoughts about all these years growing up has to do with the profound and deep respect that my grandmother, Mary Bordakovsky, had for the military. I think I've heard that per capita, Alaska Native serve at the highest rates, and among the Alaska Native, the Aleuts are the highest serving. And so maybe that's where some of that respect comes from, because my grandfather was Alaska Territorial Guard and my dad, Vietnam veteran. And yet at the same time, when I was learning about what happened during World War II, there would always be these horrific stories about the shape of the homes and the damage that was done and the personal items that were stolen and whatnot at the hands of our own, the military. And so the two scenarios that have grown up with have always kind of presented in my mind a little bit of a, like, wow, I don't know. I respect the military, and yet I also feel badly that something like that happened by our own military. I'm not even sure what my question would be.
At the time we came up here, the impression we were given, and this is voiced oral stuff, that we had nothing to stop the Japanese. They figured that the Japanese, if they had wanted to, could have come clear up in the Aleutians, taken Anchorage, and come down the east coast of Anchorage, down Vancouver to Seattle, Washington. So we were rushed up there as an additional squadron with the 18th that was up here. And the impression was given right along that if the Japs came, we were all there. We were the only force there to stop them, and we probably couldn't have with that limited force. And I was talking to my son last night, and I was thinking, you know, we didn't have much choice but to move the Aleut natives out because they could all have become prisoners of the Japanese or killed. It was probably the best thing that we could do to save the native population. It was done very poorly, sent to a bad place, and certainly wasn't handled professionally. But I still think that it was probably still the best thing to do. It's just too bad that we couldn't handle it properly.
This story was produced by KUCB's Zoe Sobel and Laura Craigle. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. We had reports tonight from Casey Grove and Palmer, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman, Ed Schoenfeld, and Matt Miller in Juneau, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Aaron Bolton in Homer, and Zoe Sobel and Laura Craigle in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. 4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. Never miss another episode of your favorite PBS primetime programs thanks to Afternoon Tea on Alaska Public Media TV. Every weekday, you can catch up on the drama of Masterpiece. Be amazed by our universe with Nature and Nova. Search for garage treasures on Antiques Roadshow and solve mysteries alongside our favorite detectives. Watch Afternoon Tea weekdays from 3 to 5 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.